I would like to redefine science as the study of those phenomena so crude that the time in which they are embedded is without consequence. And I suppose of ball bearings rolling down slopes and things like this fall into that category. But the things which interest us, love affairs, the fall of empires, the formation of political movements, these things always happen in different ways. There is no theory for much of what happens in the human world. And I maintain it's because in the human world, the invariance of time forces itself upon us. And so we create categories of human knowledge outside science, like psychology, or that's sort of a fence sitter, but advertising and political theory and this sort of thing. So that addresses the invariant time, or the variable time that we experience, and then we hypothesize a theoretical kind of time that is invariant, and that's where we do all this science that has led us into these incredibly alienating abstractions. This goes back to Newton. Newton said time is pure duration. He visualized time as an absolutely featureless surface. Well, now notice, Ralph, Aristotle's effort to describe nature with perfect mathematical solids has been abandoned long ago, because nowhere do we meet perfect mathematical forms in nature. The only perfect mathematical form that has been retained in modern scientific theory is the utterly unsupported belief that time, no matter at what scale you magnify it, will be found to be utterly featureless. There is absolutely no reason to think this, and considerable evidence to the contrary. The problem is, if we were to ever admit that time is a variable medium, 1,000 years of scientific experiment would be swept away and we would be back to Z. So it's just simply a house of cards, and better left where it stands, I think. But the fact of the matter is, there is no reason to believe that time is invariant. And experience argues the contrary.
No, but the thing is, the invariability, I mean, this seems to go a little bit beyond the problem of pigeonholing.
Well, it addresses the problem of experiment as a notion.
But I don't think it actually touches it, you see, because I think what you've been saying, if we take it down to the level of the pigeons again, it does, as you yourself say, it turned out to be an elaborate version of the rubber band theory. Rubber filigree or something like that. Anyway, the rubber band theory would say that they'd be drawn back to the loft. And the experiment of moving the loft and seeing if they can find the moved loft. Let's say they can do that. There's an experiment. It would show us something that goes beyond anything contemporary science would expect. It might or might not fit with the all-time theory.
It does fit.
But nevertheless, here we have an experiment, crude though it is, which would show that the existing scientific models are inadequate. We need something that goes beyond them. We need something that shows how the pigeon can be linked to the home. The rubber band theory does involve a kind of attraction to the home, and in that sense involves a pull in time. So it does raise all these questions, perhaps.
Well, do you have a theory about how this works? I mean, I don't see how morphogenetic fields are particularly helpful here, or if they are helpful, then in the boil down, it's the same thing I'm saying.
Yes, I think if there's a field that includes both the pigeon and its loft, say, here's the pigeon, here's its loft, normally they're together, it's normally the home. You separate them. You can either do it by moving the loft, or you can do it by moving the pigeon. But either way, they're separated. They're part of a single system, because the pigeon's world includes its loft, its home, its mates, all the rest of it. You move them, they're now separated parts of a single system, they're linked by a field. And the pigeon is attracted within this field back towards the home, which functions as the attractor. This is where me and Ralph have this different view of attractors. In dynamics, things are drawn towards attractors. And if the loft is an attractor within the field, then the pigeon is, as it were, pulled back towards the field. It doesn't need an AA roadmap of the whole of Britain. That's irrelevant. It just feels a pull in a particular direction. And so the trouble with map theory, you see, is it has all this information, that the whole of Britain, you know, star rising, all these kind of features of this roadmap. It doesn't need that. You don't need that. You only need, if you're trying to work out where you're going to go by some method of rational
calculation. Oh, well, this is the angel theory, that when I come to the fork in the road, a guardian angel appears from behind a tree and tells me which way to go.
Roughly speaking, yes. Or you just feel a pull in a particular direction. You don't even think about it. You just feel that's the way to go. And you're drawn that way. I think that's how the pigeon does it, subjectively. I don't think it necessarily needs to see the whole of its future from egg to grave. I think it feels a pull towards where its home is by this kind of invisible rubber band, which is actually, if you like, a gradient within the field towards an attractor, which is its home. I mean, that's how you could model it mathematically.
Yes.
But you wouldn't need to bring in the whole of the rest of Britain and a roadmap. Now, if you did need a roadmap for the whole of the rest of Britain and all the rest of the world, then we'd have the question, how would it get it? Well, I've got a theory how it could get it, but I think it might tune in to the collective memory of all the other pigeons that have ever gone on homing races. All of them see the ground they're flying over. If a pigeon could access the collective pigeon psyche, or take it further, even the collective memory of other species, not just pigeons. If all birds could link up to what all other birds had seen, then they would indeed have a global map of the world. They could gain access to it. But I think that's possibly going further than we need for this rather limited case. It may be more relevant in the case of migrations, where you have birds migrating over thousands of miles, in the case of cuckoos, young cuckoos, migrating to South Africa, independent of their parents that leave in July from England. The young cuckoos leave in August. They've never met their parents because they're cuckoos. And their parents, in any case, push off before the young ones are ready to fly. They go all that way. And I think in that case, they must be tuning in at least to a kind of collective cuckoo memory that includes features of the landscape over which they fly. But the rubber band theory wouldn't necessitate even that, you see. It would necessitate maybe some degree of collective memory, but it would essentially have this kind of pull, directional pull.
Well, there still seems to be some kind of problem, either a mathematical or a cognitive problem. When the loft is moved, then the dynamical system, which extends essentially over the whole of the planet, wherever this pigeon may be released, and all the way back, has to receive the feeling which direction to go from the guardian angel or whatever. And that directional field all over the planet has changed when the loft was moved. So the question arises, how does the attractor, the loft, extend its field and directional instruction all over the planet? And I don't think that the idea of morphic resonance helps here, because no other pigeon has flown to that particular loft.
No, I'm not talking about morphic resonance, I'm talking about the field itself. Morphic resonance is a memory of how to do it. If you have a magnet, say you have a magnet, a pile of iron filings here, and you have a magnet over here, and you put the magnet there, these iron filings will be drawn towards it, and you'll see lines of force moving towards it. If you then move the magnet over here, you don't have to, there's an immediate adjustment.
The loft itself simply functions as a magnet, as it were,
like
another field, which is not an electromagnetic field.
That's right.
But it's sort of an emotional field.
Yes.
And
the loft's like a magnet. And so you move the loft, it's just like moving a magnet. Automatically, now the iron filings or whatever will go there. That's basically the model I'm suggesting.
And the reason that I can't find my car in the parking garage is because I'm not emotionally attached to it, and I've never been in love with it. I could get an Italian car.
Well, it's a thing about, I mean, in the human realm, it could apply to finding people. And Jill does an experiment, well, she doesn't call it an experiment, in her workshops, where people form pairs. And they can first find each other by humming, with their eyes closed, and find the person. Then, after they've got good at that, you can then find your partner with your eyes closed, so you can't see, just by feeling where they are. And heading for them in that direction. And now that's an example of this possible magnetic pull in the human realm. I've tried doing this experiment with our children on the grounds that it ought to be particularly strong with children. And it turned out Merlin was extremely good at finding me. And then I discovered he was peeping. So I'm afraid this experiment, he couldn't quite see the value of totally objective, utterly controlled scientific study. So, I mean, maybe you see that the bonds between pigeons and their home are comparable to the bonds between people and other people, and indeed they may be related to the kind of social, that which holds societies together. When we say there's a bond between people, we may mean something more than a mere metaphor. It may be that there is an actual connection between them. And so we have many examples from the human realm. A child falls ill hundreds of miles away, and their mother immediately starts worrying and rings up on the telephone. This may be another manifestation of the same kind of thing. And it may be part of the social bonding. I mean, the motive of the pigeon to go home is social. It's not merely geographical. If it hasn't got mates and so on, it doesn't bother. If you try raising them in the winter and they've got no social motivation, they hang out wherever they can. They join into other people's lofts and so on. And it may well be that the pigeon that spent such a pleasant 10 days here at Hazelwood, like most of us, discovered this is a really nice place to be. And it didn't have a sufficiently strong motivation to get home. We may be looking here at something that's essentially a social bond, but which, because our social, we're never in exactly the same place as somebody else, two bodies can't exist, we're always separated to some degree, however small, from those we're bonded to. And often, in the case of birds that fly foraging for food, in the case of migratory birds, in the case of all animals that have to go out, bees that have to forage out from their hives and then come back, there must be some way in which these social bonds extend into a geographical dimension and then become spatial, directional bonds to find a home group. In the case of wolves, there are these cases reported by naturalists of packs of wolves that go out hunting. A wolf may be injured, sometimes they're injured, and then they stay behind in a kind of lair while the whole pack goes hunting. And there's this book by W.J. Long called How Animals Talk, about his tracking of wolves through in Canada, in the snow. The pack would go out hunting, went about 20 miles, and went around and then killed an animal quite silently, no baying, they do it quietly. And then, from the tracks, he found that the wounded wolf had taken the shortest line from where it was to the place where they'd had this kill, and joined the rest of the pack and got a meal. And the tracks showed that it had gone on a straight run, not followed the scent of where they were. And he showed it couldn't just be sound and it couldn't be smelling because the wind was blowing the wrong way. So this kind of social bond, this kind of linkage, may be utterly fundamental, you see, and the pigeon home may be related to the social field in some sense and its extension over the geographical realm.
Well, I'm sensing a kind of convergence here where even Terence could find something to agree with. That there is a sixth sense. It is a field phenomenon, like the quantum field. It's a social field. It's involved with the flocking of birds, the schooling of fish, and with herds of animals and packs of wolves. And you had a question. You started us off. What would this teach us, or what would that mean to us in terms of our future? And it could be that humans are somehow divorced from the significance of this field. So whenever the guardian angel speaks, they always do the opposite or something. And if we wanted to understand the population explosion, the demise of the planet, and all these wars and the manifestation of hatred and the sources of evil and so on, a candidate for the disharmony in the human species would be its disconnection with this field. And here's where Terence comes in, that this, somehow it's the implication of language is to submit to it is to lose your connection with the field. So we all have done experiments in not speaking, for example, meditation, for example, dreaming, where the antithesis of language has an opportunity to come forward and to attempt to reconnect us to this field, a harmonizing influence that entrains us, but not for long, especially for people like Americans who watch television for 7 hours a day. There is somehow not enough time away from language.
But notice that most prophetic episodes are dream episodes. I think that supports my point, that we've lost connection with a kind of fourth-dimensional perception that for the rest of nature is absolutely a given.
Why do you think it's a given in the rest of nature? I mean, I don't still see why you need to have the pigeon knowing the whole of its future. And
well, because you have many, many cases of this kind of thing. Animals that are put in the pound by owners who are moving, and then the owners move 700 miles and the animal escapes from the pound and it doesn't return to the ancestral home, it returns to the new apartment in a different city. The monarch butterflies, the homing pigeons, a whole host of mysterious phenomena become utterly transparent and trivial if you simply hypothesize that for them the future doesn't have this occluded character that it has for us as a result of our acquiescence in the language behavior. It seems to me it's
not just a problem in time, it's a problem in space. You could say that they know that they're going to wind up at the new home and meet, but that's still, you've got a problem how they know which way to go. And I
well, presumably they see themselves at every point in their life, not just the high or low points.
And a minute in the future,
they're
a minute ahead of where they are, so
yes.
They just go that
a
way.
In the future, they're that way.
In other words, they can always see it from where they are. It's always ahead of them, in the same way that we navigate through space. I mean, if you were a two-dimensional creature, the things that we do navigating in three-dimensional space would be absolutely mysterious and generate all kinds of metaphysical speculation and hypotheses and so forth and so on. But, I mean, why should nature imprison itself within a temporal domain? Clearly, for us, it's an artifact of language. I mean, we talk about future tenses, past tenses. Those aren't descriptive of the future and the past. They create it. That's why I put in the possible exception of perhaps there are human languages where this is not happening, and therefore they are much closer to animal perception. The mysterious, quote-unquote, mysterious behavior of the Australian Aborigines, the Hopi, these peoples, they seem capable of things that to us are like magic, but the magic is all done by knowing what's going to happen. So if they simply imbibe that animal understanding, then to them it's trivial. That seems to me the most elegant explanation. And it doesn't require new undetected fields or any of these other somewhat cobbled together mechanisms.
Just another dimension.
Well, we know it's there. There's no debate about that. Here, an example, then, to carry that forward, I've always felt that the role of shamans in Aboriginal society, especially the ones that were using psychoactive plants, that all the magic that they do suddenly becomes not so mysterious if you simply assume that by perturbing the ordinary brain states and ordinary language states, they then let in this hyperdimensional understanding. Because look at what shamans do, really. They predict weather. That's classical. That demands a knowledge of the future. They tell the tribe where the game has gone, also requiring a knowledge of the future. And they rarely lose a patient. That means they know who's going to make it and who isn't, and they refuse all cases perceived to be fatal. So here are three examples of shamanic magic, all easily explained by the simple assumption that they can perceive to some degree the future, which is occluded to ordinary people locked in ordinary language and brain states. QED.
Do the pigeons do a ritual then to get in touch with it?
No, animals are in this place to begin with. You see, look at the shaman to push this point in. What is the shaman's strategy for attaining his special knowledge? He becomes like an animal. He is master of animals. He dresses in skins. He growls.
He talks to pigeons.
He talks to the animals. He perturbs his brain state with ordeals or drugs or something like this. But the very close association of the shaman to the animal mind suggests that that's the clue to entering this atemporal or 4D perceptual sphere.
And as John mentioned at the beginning, in the Christian tradition, the principal symbol of the Holy Spirit, which is that which gives inspired prophecy, shamanic-type gifts of healing, all the gifts of the Spirit, including speaking in tongues, prophecy, healing, and so forth, discernments of various, and intuitions of various kinds, are symbolized by the Holy, by the pigeon. So there's some curious way in which the dove, well known at the biblical times for its homing powers, the Egyptians had a homing pigeon service in ancient Egypt. So the choice of the pigeon was not just plucked out of nowhere. Noah's Ark was the first biblical story of the pigeon, where the pigeon is sent off and comes back with the homers, with an olive twig. So right from the beginning, the pigeon is seen as a messenger that can find out things in distant places and come home and bring back the information. So you could say that central to the whole Western tradition, this shamanic thing of becoming like an animal, in this case, somehow entering the mind of a pigeon, or in some way assimilating to the state of a pigeon, is the basis of the gift of knowledge, prophecy, and spiritual power.
It sounds right to me.
Hmm.
So should we now...
Yes, I think so.
Let us now open this up and then...
Essentially, yes. I mean, I think it might take some time, but I think as a strategy for expanded awareness, that's how it would present itself experientially. Trappist monasteries do this. All Aboriginal peoples sequester the young men and women, often by themselves, for a period of silence. Somehow language is a strategy for holding at bay a much more complex world, that if we can by any means remove the language forming capacity,
well, even what's the trouble then? The trouble is the complete contradiction of everything you're saying. You're
well,
using the language to
Well, who was it said, I contradict myself? I contradict myself. The obsession with intellectual closure is inappropriate to talking monkeys, because nowhere is it writ large that talking monkeys should be able to achieve a complete understanding of reality. I think part of what we have to do is live with unsolved mysteries that are in principle insoluble. They're not simply unsolved problems. They're in principle mysterious. All would agree that the highest understanding resides in silence. but it's the death of conversation, hardly to speak of weekend workshops.
See, if language is so disadvantageous, and the principle of the survival of the fittest, why do you think it developed?
Well, maybe it's a maladaptive trait. Many maladaptive traits develop. I'm not willing to say that. I think it has... for us, it's a substitute for other forms of cohesion, like pheromones, which are a kind of language that knit together insect societies. Originally, we were possibly fairly... unsocial creatures. In other words, human beings may have paired and reared their children in secret. We've created societies of billions of people, and the linkage is language, and it's an unsteady linkage, as we can see. I mean, I don't have an answer for why language evolved.
Presumably, we were pack animals like wolves or horses and tribal consciousness.
Pack animals are the animals that produce complex signaling systems to coordinate themselves in space with barks and yips and yells. They coordinate hunting activity and this sort of thing. It may be that relatively benign adaptation carried further becomes something else. What we do, I think, that no other animal does, is we carry out symbolic activity. And it's this symbolic activity that has closed us off from the reality of what lies outside the symbol system.
Can you give an example of that?
Symbolic activity? Everything we do. I mean, for instance, think of a child lying in a crib with an open window and a hummingbird comes through the room. Well, this is like a miracle. It's all light and iridescence and whirring sound, and the child is sucked into the presence of a miracle. And then its nurse or its mother comes into the room and says, "It's a bird, baby, bird." Suddenly the miracle is collapsed into a lexeme, and by the time you are 5 years old, the entirety of reality has been very carefully mosaicked over with words. And to burst through that to whatever reality lies beyond is the task of a mystic or a shaman, and it's extraordinarily difficult. That's what I mean by trading in the world for symbolic signification. Well, I question whether we actually think in words or to what degree we do. What you notice when you experiment with these shamanic tools, such as psychoactive plants, is that as the intoxications deepen, thought becomes vision, and one thinks in images. And I imagine that this is the Aboriginal thought style, and we must have thought in images for a long time before we downloaded into words. To the degree that people think in images, I think they are a different sort of person than the word-oriented person. I think thinking in words may be an artifact of writing and print, and may have been most intensified in the last 1,000 years. I mean, sensory ratios are incredibly subject to cultural modification. As an example of what I mean by that, St. Augustine, to prove his piety, they would open a book of scripture in front of him, and without making a sound, he would examine it for a few minutes, and then they would close the book and question him, and he was able to discuss what was written there on the page. He was the only man in Europe, in other words, who could read silently. And it was thought a miracle. Well, we all read silently and think nothing of it. So I think the mind is very malleable and the imprint of culture very deep. You know, McLuhan suggested that the concept of the citizen, the concept of the industrial assembly line, were both artifacts of print and would have been incomprehensible in a manuscript culture. This is an area where we are very naive. How our languages affect our view of the world. As I hear what you're saying the glory of our humanness is our free will. But in fact, you're right, the decisions that we make form us as individuals, not as a species. And so in an animal situation, the individual animal, I think, is not what is of interest there. We differentiate ourselves from each other by the choices that we make, and that requires this unknowable future dimension. This
you just poo-poo it, so we don't need it. It's an illusion.
Well, I didn't poo-poo it. I said animals don't have it. Clearly, we are of a different order. I'm not a pro-animal, anti-human sort. I mean, I think the human world is definitely the most interesting world, but I think maybe you've put your finger on it, that without this illusion of an unknowable future, we would not differentiate as individuals. So it's a happy flaw, O Felix Culpa, right?
But some people have always been afraid of prophecy, but that you have the moral
Well, it raises real questions about free will, that's for sure. I mean, one can suppose it raises real questions. I mean, if a prophecy comes true, does that mean then that in principle all of the future is determined? You see, we have to avoid determinism here, because a true determinism means thinking is pointless. Because in a rigid determinism, you think what you think because you couldn't think anything else. So the concept of truth is utterly without meaning in a rigid determinism. So perhaps in the pursuit of truth, the unknown future is a necessity, and it allows our individuation from each other, and that is the particular hallmark of our species, is that we are a population of individuals, not a population that is defined genetically.
Well, this is a challenge, isn't it?
These language structures are very provisional. Every culture assumes that it is building an edifice of eternal truth, but every culture has all other cultures as examples before it of parochiality, provincialism, and limited understanding. Why we then should assume that our culture is any more provisional than any other is simply a matter of hubris and historical momentum. I don't think the meaning of human existence lies in culture. It lies in the individual. And to access that meaning, a certain amount of deconditioning, i.e. alienation, has to take place from a culture. If you're just a cheerful representative of your culture, you're a kind of mindless bore, whether you represent Japanese culture, Indonesian culture, or whatever. We require distance between ourselves and the object of our contemplation in order to define ourselves.
And I think, to go on with this, that Terence earlier pointed out, the animal state is pre-language, but the state advocated by mystics and all great religions is to go beyond language. It's not none of the great religious or spiritual traditions say human culture is the end, is where it's at. All of them point beyond it, and all of them point to states of contemplation, mystical insight, prayer, intuition, which go beyond the limitations of language. So I didn't take what Terence was saying to be a denigration of all human culture or language, but pointing out its limitations, which are agreed on by the greatest traditions we have. Well, I think in a sense, all these animals can be our teachers, you see. And I think that the part of my interest in the homing pigeons, and indeed the other experiments that I've been thinking about lately, is to help to see us as much more to the natural world, and certainly much more to the animal world, than current models allow. The current models of biology, of institutional biology, say all animals and plants are pure machines, totally explainable in terms of A-level physics. And they don't even take quantum physics into it. And if you do, then you get weird phenomena like non-locality, which would mean pigeon homing might not be such a mystery. But so the attempt to reduce all animals and the whole of nature has been going on for a long time, and it's part of the triumphalist culture we have. Our culture is based on an agenda of conquering nature. We can conquer the whole of nature, and now we've told every other culture in the world that's where it's at, development programs, logging operations, and so on. So the ecological crisis is a result of working out this particular way of thinking about nature and other species. I think that recovering a sense of... I don't think that anybody here is saying we've got to say animals are better than us and denigrate the whole human race, but to recognize that there are astonishing powers in the animal and the other realms of nature, which we've just simply been blind to. We're blind to them if we think in terms of institutional science. People who actually know animals well, people who train horses, who keep dogs and cats, and who actually observe their behavior, know full well that they have very often uncanny or seemingly uncanny powers of knowing, which go beyond what we would expect on the basis of textbook biology. So I think these are ways of learning more about the world in which we live and more about the biological context of our lives. And when we come to dolphins, then they're indeed, if we take big brains to be the criterion of our superiority to the rest of the animal kingdom, then we have to face the fact that whales and several other animals have bigger brains than us. And what are they doing with all that cerebral capacity? They're certainly not building media empires and constructing television programs and so on. So I think that this interest in dolphins and whales as having a different kind of consciousness and possibly a more harmonious and telepathic consciousness is another way in which people are trying to learn from the animal kingdom. But, I mean, it creates a kind of humility in ourselves, doesn't it, to realize that here are these astonishing social forms based on kinds of consciousness quite different from our own, and possibly more advanced in certain ways. And all we regard them, at least all the Japanese fishermen regard the dolphins as nuisances for getting in the way of their drift nets. And the whales are simply a resource to be exploited, and Norwegians want to resume it because it's good for the people to save job losses in northern Norway, that kind of thing. There's a clash of value systems here. I think the whole of our modern civilization is in crisis because of this clash of value systems. So what's really going on in the rest of nature?
Rediscovering what's happening is very important. It does
have wider consequences for our future as a species and a civilization.
These are not mere questions of idle curiosity. Well, I find this a little dissatisfying somehow to stop on this point. We didn't resolve what I think is the basic question about the homing pigeon, especially in connection with its significance for ourselves, because here we have a couple of divergent views. Even if we concede that the loft radiates a field, that the homing pigeon follows this field by a process of clairvoyance in which it has a precognition of its position a moment hence and just goes in that direction, there's still, I think, the fundamental question has to do with the utter determinism of this, and whether the homing pigeon sees a variety of future positions and has to test them out by some process to determine which one is the most connected to the loved one or to the home, or whether there is only one vision and it just follows it. That's the fundamental question, because thinking of our species as the homing pigeon, and we're hoping to get home. If the future is totally determined, probably the likeliest outcome is the demise of the entire species, if not the biosphere itself. And of course, there's no trouble for Terence having accepted that. But most people, I think, are seeing a variety of possible outcomes and seeking a way to ennoble their own life by philosophical position of empowerment, in which what you do, which choice you make, by what criteria you prioritize the possible futures, would actually lead in one direction instead of the other one. Thus, in the context of free will for the homing trajectory of the entire species, life obtains a moral meaning. If it matters what we do, that's one thing. If it doesn't matter what we do, that's another. Therefore, it sort of matters whether it matters or not, if you see what I mean.
I think Bell's theorem in quantum theory said there's this principle that if things have been part of the same system and they're separated, they retain an instantaneous correlation, even if they're miles apart, even if they're going apart at the speed of light. Now, this is part of quantum theory, and it's totally unlike anything in conventional physics. And so the whole pigeon is separated from its home or from its loved ones, and if Bell's theorem applies at the larger scale, then you could say they're part of the same system. They retain a non-local or non-separable connection. And this could be the basis of the rubber band or the homing system or whatever. You could say that. The trouble is that physicists don't know whether Bell's theorem applies in the larger scale or not. Most of them want an easy life, and so they say, oh, well, Bell's theorem's fine if you're dealing with these microscopic systems. It doesn't seem to have any effects anywhere else. We'll just regard it as a peculiar feature of microscopic physics. It could be that there are other physicists, including Ralph's friend Nick Herbert, who's spent years puzzling and wrestling with the consequences of Bell's theorem, thinking it must or may have implications at the larger scale realm. And you see, homing pigeons may indeed, I think, come to be seen as a large-scale manifestation of the same principle. I mean, I myself think that's quite a likely possibility. But Ralph knows Nick better and has talked about these things more. So what do you think about that, Ralph?
Well, what I think is that quantum mechanics applies to a different realm, and it provides us with metaphors, and Bell's theorem is a stimulating metaphor to understand this phenomenon of bonding. But to take this model too seriously seems to me ridiculous.
Well, this is the thing that they've been trained to do. And if you think about it, you see, under normal conditions, no bird or animal would ever do this. Yeah. In a homing experiment, the pigeon is captured by the owner grabbing it, putting it inside a basket, and it's transported on a train or a lorry for hundreds of miles. Well, in nature, that doesn't happen to animals very much. If they go away from home, they usually go under their own steam. And the normal circumstances is the pigeons range out from Trafalgar Square or wherever they live, and they forage. In Trafalgar Square, they don't have to go far usually because all these tourists feed them there. But normally, pigeons live on buildings or on rocks. The original habitat of the homing pigeon it's a rock pigeon. Lives on rocks, on cliffs. That's why they like buildings in London, because they like cliffs. And they go out and forage, and they find their way home. That's the biological basis, and they've somehow got this to a very high degree, and they've been selected over many generations. But they have all the normal bird life as well.
The palace is a bit like that as well, isn't it? It kind of operates in slightly odd circumstances.
And these pigeons have also been selected very strongly over many generations. Pigeons that aren't very good at homing don't make it back from races, and they don't get bred from in the next generation. So there's been tremendously strong selection. Anyway, yes, I think that how this relates to human affinities and so on comes back to this question of the social bonding being the underlying basis for all these forms of behaviour, and what forms of affinity or bonding are involved. We don't know much. Yes, but that's another subject. I think maybe. Well, maybe it's. Well, maybe it isn't. But
it makes a bond which draws two unlikely people together. Mm. I remember it's the love that takes it back to its children, eggs, and nests.
Well, some people would find that an unflattering comparison because we like to think human love different. But I think that would.
But we'll call it homing from now on.
I'll home.